ID or any ID, the required identification, you will cast a provisional ballot, and then you'll have a certain time frame to show, you know, to go to your local election office and show the proper ID. You know, some data points we will be able to collect, hopefully, is how many provisional ballots were issued because of that, and how many people came back and showed their ID. There are a few states, or at least jurisdictions across the country, that are starting to track that data. And while that's only sort of part of the question, that can start to give us a little of a peek into what are going to be the impacts of different types of ID laws. Because, as you know, there's so many different types of ID requirements across states. You have some states, you know, I live in Washington, D.C., there is no ID requirement. I show up and I state my name and I sign in, and that's all I have to do. While you have states, for example, now like Indiana and Georgia, where you need to show a photo ID, or you're going to need to cast a provisional ballot. And then there's every sort of variation in between where you can show a utility bill in some states or a non-photo ID. So really, there's, as you know, there's just a lot of variation.
Well, I think that's a very, very important point you're raising, Sean. And we're talking to Sean Green, who's the research director for the Pew Charitable Trust Election Initiative, and they just put out a very interesting study on voter participation across the states in 2012. But wasn't, I may be wrong, but Arizona is obviously a place where there's been a lot of agitation around voting access and rights. And I thought I'd read somewhere, Sean, and you probably know if this is me just stepping on the wrong track or correct, that there was a huge number of provisional ballots they had in the last election.
There were a very large number, one of the highest rates in the country, not the highest rate. And they've also had high rates of provisional ballots in the past. And I think, you know, there's a couple of reasons that happened specifically this time around in 2012 in Arizona. And they're mostly out of Maricopa County, which is where Phoenix is, which I think accounts for, you know, maybe, you know, 60 or 70% of the state's voters there. You know, in Arizona, they have, like a few other states, permanent vote by mail, which where you can sign up to get you can get a mail ballot forever, right? Not every time you have to sign up. You just sign up and you're going to get a mail ballot for as long as you stay in that state and stay in your residence. And I think what's happened in Arizona, we saw a lot of the reasons people were given provisional ballots were because they were people who'd received mail ballots but hadn't cast them. They hadn't received them, they forgot they got them, so they show up at the polls. And the rules are in Arizona and in some other states where if you're a person who's received a mail ballot, you're going to have to cast a provisional ballot when you show up at the polls because they have to be sure you haven't cast a mail ballot. And they usually go back and some of the people haven't cast a ballot and they have to cast a provisional ballot. I mean, the challenge with provisional ballots, of course, is it's not a regular ballot. It's not counted with regular ballots. It takes longer to process. And a voter's not going to know for a longer period of time, you know, whether the vote was counted or not. They can call and check in later or check a website to see if the provisional ballot was counted. But ideally, of course, you'd really want everyone to be able to cast a regular ballot in every state. So, yeah, I think that's my understanding of what's happening in Arizona.
And it could get worse. I think that the court just said that it was going to be okay for them to also check citizenship papers for all voters at the next election in Arizona. So, boy, I'd put money on the fact there are going to be longer delay times then.
Well, you know, but we know what's great about Arizona and Maricopa County. They're one of the best counties when it comes to tracking these data, which is great for, you know, transparency and for knowing what's going on. So anyone, they have data all over their website, which shows things about really particular details about provisional ballots. Not just about how many were cast and counted and rejected, but really they even have demographic breakdowns of who is casting them and where they're casting them from. So that's the type of thing that our index encourages. It's that type of data collection and transparency, which I think really helps us better understand how our elections are doing. And, of course, one of the reasons why we do our election performance index is to just encourage better data collection. So not just that, you know, this is for policymakers and election officials to sort of see what's going on and to actually maybe see what policies are working well and aren't working well. But it's also for voters to see how their voting systems are working and how their taxpayer dollars are working. Obviously, elections are run by our taxpayer dollars, so it seems, you know, quite reasonable to want to know how the elections are doing.
Well, that's a good point. So there's a lot of, you know, sound and fury about all these efforts to potentially suppress or restrict access to the ballot, but there must be states that are stepping up to the mark and are actually passing legislation to improve access to the ballot. And do you see much of that coming across your desk, Sean?
Well, yeah, you know, I think, you know, one of our indicators and what research has shown is that more and more states are moving to online voter registration. You know, in 2008, there were two states that allowed online voter registration. That was Arizona and Washington. And then by 2012, it was 13 states. And even since then, we're almost up to 20 states that now allow online voter registration. And I think there's three or four more that are considering implementing online voter registration on the mix of building those systems. And the reason that, you know, it does a couple of good things. One, it does provide access to voters for wherever to be able to register and update their information themselves. So they can do it directly, and they can make the changes themselves, which leads to more accurate voter rolls and more up-to-date voter rolls. On top of that, it's proven to be pretty popular in these states. Voters really like the option to be able to register for the first time or to update their address. I mean, that's the most common thing. If people move within a state, they move within a county, of course, you need to update your address. It's really easy to do that online. And we also found that in the long run, it saves dollars. And again, I said it's been quite popular with voters. And it's something that more and more states are moving to. It's one of our recommendations for states like Arkansas is to consider things like moving to online voter registration.
Well, unfortunately, the problem you have in, you know, lower income states like Arkansas and Louisiana and Texas and many places in the South is you don't have that internet access. The city where I live, I think I live in New Orleans. I think we're still not up to 50% internet access across the city just because of income and access and cost issues. So it's a good point you're making that online access, if you have online access, makes it easier to register, particularly for young voters coming in. And I guess we can hope for smartphones allowing you to get on a website because those are becoming a lot more prevalent.
Exactly. And I think that's where it actually, so more and more states are actually trying to get these onto smartphones because they know more and more people across all income levels actually are using their phones as their main point of internet access. And so what more states are trying to do is move their online system just to be on mobile apps. And I think the more states that do that and add that, you're going to hopefully address some of those issues and your concerns that you're talking about where, you know, income gaps can have an effect on who has access to the internet.
Well, and particularly because income demographics also impact, you know, party preferences and election, you know, outcomes for candidates. So it is one of those things in this whole, you know, inequality concern that is more and more worrisome, particularly if you don't live on the coast or in some of your higher income states, this is going to become an issue. Now, I noticed some of the states are starting to have pre-registration for young people at 16, 17 years old. Is that becoming more common? Because that could also, I guess, help for first-time registration.
Sure. It's not something we measure for this index, but I don't know off the top of my head how many states do it, but it is several states that have pre-registration, which, you know, so what is when you get your, if you get a driver's license, they will mark you as pre-registered, and then when you turn 18, you will be automatically registered to vote and get that information in the mail that, you know, we have, you get your registration card. And my understanding is the states that have used it have found that it's worked well. I don't have that off the top of my head of how many, you know, how many young people have used it, how it's worked in different states. But, yeah, there are several states that are doing it.
You know, one thing that worries me, and it's the same point about online registration, is you have states like Texas. And I don't know that Texas did that well on your survey. We'll get into that. But in Texas, they're now requiring special testing and training requirements for anybody who acts as a registrar of voters. Now, you have online registration in some places, you're saying, which is a breakthrough. Then you have almost what it seems to be, you know, boulders in the road in places like Texas where clearly they're making it harder to be a registrar. I don't know how they're going to get access.
Right, and that's why, you know, in Texas as well, you know, they perform just about the same as Arkansas in our index in 2012. And I think that's why for both states we're recommending online voter registration because, as you know, what that does is that it just avoided the issue entirely
exactly.
of the question of sort of third-party registration groups, right? And what's nice about that is, and we've actually heard in the states that have online voter registration, is that they work with third-party registration groups to use online voter registration. They actually work cooperatively with these groups. I mean, it's made it easier for them, but what it also has done is allowed third-party registration groups to really actually focus more on get out the vote, which is more of what I think they really want to do, right, is just to really help to focus on the get out the vote sort of side of their work. And if they can get more people to register online without having to use our services, it's probably, you know, it's probably better for everybody.
Well, there's no question. I mean, thanks to the magic of Google, you may or may not know, up until 2008, I ran Acorn, and we did registrations for every cycle at the end for a million and a half people. Clearly, if I was doing it now, and I would still be doing it, I mean, none of this right-wing stuff would intimidate me, putting in a smartphone with people, a mini pad or an iPad, that if you had online registration and you find somebody who's not registered, boom, you do it then. Because the whole problem was, you know, by law in all these states, you have to turn in every form that's signed, even if you know it's fraudulent. We used to have to turn in one stack that was good and a smaller stack, but still a stack that we suspected was bad because you didn't have any choice under the law. Now, later on, it'll all be, you know, somebody will try to make some mischief. But online registration for somebody out in the field could be dynamic.
Right, and we've heard that that's been the reaction in some of the states, and it's really been, it's worked well. And as I said, there's been a lot of cooperation between some of the states and these groups. And I think it's made it easier for both the state and the third-party groups.
At the same time, there's less third-party registration, but I'm sure that's not part of what you studied. But can you tell at all from your data points where there seem to be significant registration efforts?
Well, you know, we not in our particular data points in the index, but there are data points out there. You know, what's interesting is that, motor voter law passed over 20 years ago now, right?
Right.
And what's interesting, and that, of course, is the most common place that people have interaction with their local government, is the DMV. And, you know, there still hasn't been a lot of research done. I mean, we've tried to do some research, and it's been actually hard to find data on how well our state's doing with having, you know, successful voter registrations at motor vehicle offices. It's actually, it's hard to find that out. And that seems like a huge point
generation?
We need to know more about, because in some states it seems like obviously 40, 50, 60% of the registrations are coming from motor voters. But in some, it doesn't seem as high. And it would be really good to know what's going on. There are states like Delaware where they've sort of automated the motor voter process at their DMV, where people use a kiosk at the DMV, and it automatically asks you if you want to register or not. You have to complete that process saying yes or no before you go on to do your DMV business, and it actually just populates your voter registration with your whatever you put in for your licensing information. So that seems to be a place that's either, you know, it would be great to have more data, and it seems right opportunity where people are having these coming interactions. For the state government, they're generally not thinking about voting. They're thinking about, can you change my address, and to update my name, and to get a new license. But they're using the same information one would need for a voter registration form. So that's an area where I think it would be great to get more data and to see how well states are doing when it comes to people registering to vote at DMVs.
Well, that sounds like an excellent point. And we're talking to Sean Green, who's the research director for the Pew Charitable Trust's Election Initiative, about their recent report on results for 2012. In our conversation, Sean, you've mentioned a couple of things that are recommendations in the report, more online voting and this, that, and the other. But one of the things that was one of your recommendations that I found intriguing was requiring a post-election audit. Now, that's a heck of a good idea. Does anybody do that, or flesh that out for the listeners?
Sure. So first out of 30 states and the District of Columbia do have post-election audits. So what a post-election audit generally is that after election, there's just it's not a recount. You know, recount is when there's actually, you know, a close contest and you just saw a candidate count. It's with a certain percentage, and they want to recount the ballots to make sure everyone is exactly right as it was checked. An audit just automatically happens after every election at the local level, where there'll be a small percentage, maybe 1% of the ballots, will be looked at again to make sure the totals match what's actually on the ballot. And what that does is just, it helps measure how well your voting technology is working. And then they have procedures in place if you have, you know, most of the time those audits work out fine and they show your voting technology is working very well. And there might be one or two paper ballots where there was a stray mark that caused it to go one way or another, and you can address that then because you do an audit and you can see that. If there are larger issues, then you can go back and explore even more of the ballots and see what was going on. But what it really is just it's just a really good way to check and to see how your voting technology is actually working when it's put in the field.
Well, I should look into that because let me tell you, in Louisiana, no one believes, in New Orleans at least, that their absentee ballot is ever counted. And I don't know if they do post-election audits in Louisiana. Do you know offhand?
I don't know, but it is something I can...
Well, I'd almost bet money they don't.
They don't have them in Arkansas.
Yeah, well, I mean, and we sure need them is all I'm saying, whether it's Arkansas, Texas, Louisiana... Go ahead.
Louisiana and Arkansas.
Okay. Well, and
yeah, Louisiana and Arkansas don't have them. And you know, it's a bit of an arcane sort of part of the elections process. But obviously, a number of states use it, and I think they find that not only for them, but also it gives voters confidence as well to know that the voting technology is constantly being checked out. Especially now, I mean, voting technology. In a lot of states and jurisdictions, it's getting older, and people are going to need to replace voting technology soon. That's a whole other issue, where that's going to cost money, and you know what technology are states and localities going to go to? I think that's sort of the next big thing coming in the next, you know, maybe by the 2016 election, if not then and soon after, when you have sort of aging voting technology, what happens next?
Well, and if you have a long memory, I mean, I can remember back way we made money in the early days of Acorn in 70, 71, 72 was actually getting our members to go to polling precincts and call in the voting count as soon as they made it public when the poll closed in Arkansas for, you know, the big television stations, which were all the rage then, so that they'd be able to predict the voting. So, I mean, that seems so old school that you waited until the paper was, you know, posted on the door essentially saying what the turnout was. You ran to a phone booth because you didn't have cell phones, you called in. So, yeah, there's a lot of changes. And you mentioned, you know, the other thing that was a surprise to me on some of your recommendations is on online tools, you said Vermont and California are trailing in that area. And, you know, you think of California as breaking ground, and Vermont, you know, always sort of touts its, you know, strength of its democracy, but wasn't it surprising to you that they don't have those tools?
It was, you know, I think in California, a lot of the county websites, and so what we're talking about for these lookup tools is that there's a state election website, it's the Secretary of State's website. If I go there as a voter, can I look up, we measure five tools, can I look up things of, am I registered to vote or not? Can I look up where my polling place is? If I cast the original ballot, can I check that online? If I cast a mail ballot, can I track what's happening to my mail ballot? And finally, can I get my sample ballot based on my precinct online by just putting in my information? And there's, you know, about 10 or so states that have all of those tools. All right, California and Vermont don't have any of those. I think in the case of California, almost every county has some of those tools at the county level, but they just don't have them actually on the state election website yet, which is where people tend to go first when first they go to Google. And then if they're going to look at this, they're going to look at their state site. So we just think, and I think my understanding is Vermont's trying to build a new system and move in that direction, which is encouraging. But right, most states are adding more and more of these tools because it's more and more meeting a lot of voters' expectations. When they look for information, a lot of people look online. That's the first place they think. And the first place they think you do go Google. I just type in, you know, where's my polling place? Am I registered to vote? These are the fairly common questions you start hearing around Election Day. You know, in some states, and they do great information of putting right up there things about what you need for Election Day, what type of ID do I need, those types of pieces of information that are really sort of basic that people need to know where they vote, if they're registered, and what they're going to need when they cast the ballot.
Sean, we're drawing to a close. Tell people how they can contact you or the election initiatives at Pew Charitable Trust to get a copy of this report or any other information.
Sure. Yeah. This is a great, our report is an online interactive. So what's really good about it is you get to jump around and pick states and pick different sort of measurements as you like. And that website is www.pewcharitablecharitable.org. pewstates.org, and Pew is P-E-W, pewstates.org/EPI, and EPI is for Elections Performance Index. So yeah, people should go and check it out and just jump around from and compare states and see what they find.
Excellent. This is Wade Rathke. This has been Wade's World on KABF 88.3 on your dial, www.kabf.org. You can get the podcast of this by Monday or Tuesday of next week. Sean Green, thank you. Next Friday, I hope we'll be talking about the Wilbur Mills Expressway and what that's really done in Little Rock. Thank you.